A little bit of luck today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. Divers rescue more boys from that flooded cave in northern Thailand.
It seems that luck was on their side. They were doing the operation faster than they expected.
Also, an 8-year-old girl and her mom, separated at the border, are finally reunited after almost 2 months apart. The mother worries about the future, though.
And we're still living with a feeling of panic, because if they separated us once, who's to say they won't do it again?
Plus, President Trump heads to London later this week, and the Trump baby balloon is ready to greet him.
He's got some very small orange hands, and in one of the hands, he's holding a phone logged into Twitter so he could tweet at all times.
Those stories and much more coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. 8 boys rescued, 4 more and their soccer coach still trapped underground. That's where things stand with the rescue effort at that flooded cave complex in northern Thailand. It's been more than 2 weeks since the group was left stranded by rising waters inside the complex. Divers are now in a race against time and the weather to get everyone out. Heavy rains are in the forecast this week for Thailand's Chiang Rai province, and that could quickly pour more water into the caves. Earlier today, the rescue was paused to allow divers to replenish oxygen supplies for the next mission. My colleague Noporn Wong Anan is following the effort for the BBC's Thai service.
According to the governor of Chiang Rai, who was the head of the operation, he had a press conference this afternoon, Thailand time, saying that the first 4 boys who've been rescued are in great conditions. They are happy, they can talk, and they even joke that they want to have their favorite food, which is equivalent of hamburger. This is rice and pork and basil leaf with chilies, which is still a bit too early for them because they need their body to adjust to the current condition now.
What about the latest 4 boys who were released? Do we know what condition they're in?
We don't have any information at all. The reason is that the operation resumed at about 11 in the morning local time, and it took about 8 to 9 hours to get them out. And we only could see the ambulances that took them to the hospital, and that's all the access that we had. So we haven't heard anything officially from the authorities as yet.
Do we know how they chose who gets rescued when? Was it based on the health of the boys?
What the governor has said before is that whoever is strong enough mentally and physically, they'll come out first. And you have to consider basic diving and swimming skill as well. Some of them were not able to swim nor dive before, and then they were given crash course on swimming and diving. And so whoever were ready, come out first.
Have the 8 boys who've been rescued, have any of them been able to see their families yet?
Not yet, because they were still being kept in the hospital. And what we understand is that the parents have not been sent to see them yet. Also, the parents haven't been informed of which kids have been rescued. And the reason is that, according to the governor, he said that he don't want any of these parents to feel left out or unfairly treated by the authorities. So they haven't got any name out yet. The authorities have been trying to protect their privacy every step that they did. Even today, when they took the boys from the ambulances to the helicopter pad, they put up these umbrellas to cover these boys, not to let the media see them.
Wow, that's amazing. I just assumed that they would notify the parents immediately. Have we heard any more details about what the journey has been like through these tunnels during the rescues?
No, we haven't been able to talk to anybody yet. It's very treacherous and it's time-consuming. But it seems that luck was on their side. They were doing the operation faster than they expected.
Do we know whether the Navy SEALs who are accompanying the boys, are they sort of literally carrying them, or do we know what goes on in there?
From what we understand is that it's not the Navy SEALs who's been taking these boys out. It's the international professional divers who were helping them. And each of the boys has to be accompanied by 2 divers, one in the front and one in the back.
What do we know about the condition of the 4 boys and the coach still trapped in the cave?
The authorities have been saying that they are in good condition, in good spirit, and they have doctor with them, keeping them company, giving food, oxygen, getting them entertained somehow.
What are rescuers doing outside the cave to prepare for the next rescues? Are there like lots of air tanks ready to go in?
Precisely. You have to replace all these empty air tanks and brought in new tanks and put them into the storage, which is in chamber 3 inside the cave. And lots of them are still doing the water pumping. You still have the electricity wiring and communication wiring all over the area there.
Is it getting riskier for the rescue with each day?
The authorities were worried about the heavy rains coming that's going to make the water level in the cave rise. But according to the governor at the press conference today, he was saying, oh, we were managing just fine with the level of water. We could continue to pump the water out and divert the water elsewhere. So the water is not in the cave as much as they anticipated for.
And do we have any kind of firm time of when the next rescue mission will resume?
Presumably, it's going to be tomorrow. That's not official as yet. But if you look at what happened in the past 2 days, these divers need some rest and depends on the weather conditions as well. Looks like it's going to be tomorrow.
My BBC colleague, Noporn Wong Anan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Hopefully, all those boys trapped in the cave in Thailand will be reunited with their families soon. We turn our attention now to a different story about parents purposely separated from their kids by the U.S. government. I'm talking about more than 2,000 children who were split from their parents under President Trump's so-called zero-tolerance immigration policy. Most of those families remain apart as the administration struggles to meet a court-ordered deadline to reunite them. But a few parents have gotten their kids back. One such reunion happened here in the Boston area last week, as we hear now from the world's Rupa Shenoy.
Sandy Gonzalez Garcia looked like any other 8-year-old, blowing out the candles on her frozen-themed cake, happily beating a piñata hanging from a tree, and singing. You'd never suspect Sandy had her real birthday a few weeks ago in a shelter on the other side of the country with other kids deemed unaccompanied minors by the government. Many who, like her, had been separated from their parents by U.S. Border Patrol. Sandy was in a shelter for 2 months without seeing her mother. She won't talk about what that was like, no matter how many times her mom, Angelica, asks her. Angelica can tell her daughter doesn't trust her the way she used to.
La verdad es que me tiene preocupada. No ha hablado mucho del tema. Le pregunto muchas veces y no me.
I'm worried about her. I asked her about it, but she doesn't answer me. She's not like how she was before. Before, she was friendlier, happier. She used to play with her friends. Now she's scared of other kids. Not sure why. And then she doesn't sleep well. She wakes up in the night, shaking, crying, screaming.
Angelica's lawyers have told her not to talk about what happened in Guatemala, what prompted them to leave, beyond the fact that it involved violence. Whatever it was sent her and Sandy fleeing north on a costly, dangerous journey, despite what Angelica knew about President Trump's immigration policies.
When I decided to come here, I wasn't thinking about anything. I didn't think about him. I just wanted to get here.
At the Arizona border, U.S. officials detained them in a small cell with dozens of other mothers and children. One morning, they were roused at 5 a.m. and taken to a trailer, and Angelica was told to bathe and dress Sandy. When it became clear they were going to be separated, Angelica hugged Sandy and told her not to cry. Angelica was sent to a detention center in Colorado. Weeks later, a judge released her on bond, and she came to Massachusetts to stay with a childhood friend from her hometown. She finally learned Sandy was being held at a facility in Texas.
Oh, fue un gran procedimiento. Tuve que ingresar documentación como una patrocinadora, no como su madre, como una patrocinadora que la iba a cuidar.
It was such a process. I had to do paperwork like I'm her guardian, not like I'm her mother. They asked me all these questions, like how much I earn, where I'm going to live with her, what care I can give. Just to speak with her, I had to send a photocopy of my ID, my birth certificate, her birth certificate. Then they listened in on our call to see if I was really her mom. All this kept me from speaking with her.
When they did talk, Sandy begged Angelica to come and get her. So when Angelica was told it would take weeks, even months, to process her 36-page so-called reunification request, proving she was a fit parent with stable housing, Angelica knew she needed help. She connected with the director of the Metro West Workers Center, a Boston-based group created to help immigrant workers organize for better pay and health care. Their network of volunteers connected Angelica with pro bono lawyers within 24 hours.
And the attorney general actually came down and spoke with her And then she spoke about that experience on the Rachel Maddow Show that night.
Martha Yeager and I talk while Sandy plays with birthday party favors. Yeager's a Metro West staffer and says ever since Trump was elected, the mostly white group's been looking for ways to help undocumented immigrants. First, they tried organizing volunteer emergency response teams who'd try to get in the way during ICE arrests, but that never really worked. One undocumented worker finally told them if they really want to help, they should just come along for court appearances or immigration appointments, things like that, to provide a measure of protection. They call it accompaniment.
Because I'm standing next to them and talking to them at the checkout line and in the grocery, do they get treated differently? I don't know for sure. I suspect that they do get treated differently. Let's just say the Trump base is real around here. I happen to live in a neighborhood where I think all of my neighbors voted for Trump.
Volunteer Liz Garrigan-Byerly is a pastor at a local church, and she offered Angelica a place to stay while her lawyers worked on an emergency order to get Sandy back. And Liz remembers wondering what Angelica must think of her middle-class home.
Yeah, and she walked in and she said, this house is so grand. And at one point we went down in my basement to find something, and it sort of just kept going. Yeah, seeing the home through her eyes and how much we have when she's literally carrying what she now has in her hands. But that's also part of accompaniment, is to set aside my own discomfort and feelings of awkwardness, because that really doesn't matter in the moment. This woman has just been through hell and back, and the least I can do is not worry about what she thinks of me.
There was a lot to coordinate with Angelica's schedule.
It's challenging. I've not been this tired since I had an infant, probably.
They used Google Translate on Liz's phone to communicate.
She talks a lot about what it was like in the Colorado prison, and she feels some sense of responsibility for speaking on behalf of others until they have the strength and the capacity to speak for themselves.
Like the other women Angelica was held with in Colorado, women who may not be as lucky as her to have help. 5 days ago, when Angelica was finally reunited with Sandy, it was a moment they had to share with cameras and lights and lots of people watching.
Tantas cámaras, tantas personas, tantos... No sé ni cómo... Me sentí extraño.
So many cameras, so many people. It felt strange. I felt like running away, but I had to wait for my girl. And when she finally arrived, I felt like I wanted to be alone with her, ask her how she was and what happened. But I couldn't because everyone was there. I just couldn't be alone with her.
Sandy doesn't seem to want to talk about it.
Había bastante gente. No sé.
Now Sandy just wants to play, and she has plenty of room. A volunteer's given them a small cottage in the backyard of her big New England home. It's in a green meadow, surrounded by forest. Angelica and Sandy will need help with transportation because it's a bit remote. But that's low on a long list of Angelica's concerns.
I think we're living through something that neither I nor my daughter fully understand yet. And we're still living with a feeling of panic, because if they separated us once, who's to say they won't do it again?
For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Boston.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. We have a balloon story now, and it's not the one you're thinking of. We'll get to that one later in the show. This one's about a South Korean sculptor who makes visually stunning works out of latex, but the artist himself can't appreciate them firsthand because he can barely see them. Jason Strother has that story from just outside of Seoul.
Go Hong-suk and his wife No Yumi greet me at the door of their 13th floor apartment. With a large work table at its center, this loft isn't just their home, it's also Hong-suk's art studio. This sculptor doesn't work with clay.
A blue balloon is springing up.
Hong-suk creates balloon sculptures. I know what you're thinking, dogs and pirate swords, but that's not what the 45-year-old makes. He creates detailed installations composed of thousands of colored balloons. One sculpture was of a 9-meter-long dragon wrapped around a unicorn. Another looked like a 3-meter-high flower, but it was a depiction of the inner vortex of a typhoon. Hong Sok tells me that if it weren't for balloons, he doesn't know where he'd be now.
제 개인적인 어떤 삶을 찾기 위한 어떤 여러 가지 방법 중에
Balloons gave me my life back, and through them, I create art.
When Hong Sok was a teenager, he was diagnosed with Behçet's syndrome, a disorder that inflames blood vessels. The disease attacked his eyes, and he gradually lost his vision. He's now legally blind.
우선은 이 앞에 우리 계신 제이슨 얼굴을 전혀
Even though I'm facing you, Jason, I can't really see your face. I can't see your shape or size. I just see your basic outline. I've lost about 90% of my vision.
Take me back to this time in high school when you were losing your vision. How did you feel as your vision was fading away?
그 상황에 대해서 좀 당황스럽게 받아들인 부분이 있지 않았나 싶어요. 그래서
I was embarrassed. I couldn't read books anymore, but it also hurt because of the inflammation. It was a period where I locked myself away from the world.
Hong Sok says he knew he couldn't stay locked away forever, so he forced himself out of his house and tried learning new things.
Learning new things was part of the process of getting my life back together. I saw an ad that a cultural center was holding a class on balloon art. I registered and liked it, so I took other professional courses and started training as a balloon artist. I enjoyed translating the images in my imagination into real shapes.
Hey, 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 hey. He's made me a very delightful heart-shaped balloon with lots of little bubbles.
At first, Hong Sok made party favors like this. He recreated Disney cartoons and fairy tale characters, drawing from his memory of what they looked like. But his sculptures grew bigger and bigger, as did his fame. He started making more and more abstract pieces of art, and last year he held his first solo exhibition in the U.S. Hong Sok says in some ways, his vision makes him a better artist.
기술적인, 감각적인 부분은 내 눈으로 보면서 하는 것보다 손의 감각적인 부분으로 할 수 있는...
I depend on my sense of touch, not vision. I think in creating balloon art, a person who can't see can achieve as much as a fully sighted person. People who could see are influenced by other artists' work. In some way, my visual limitation enhances my originality.
In his home studio, Hong Sok knows where all of his materials are. He keeps his red, green, and blue balloons separated in their own drawers. But because of their size and the short lifespan of balloons, all of Hong Sok's sculptures are made on location and just days ahead of the exhibition date. He also works with several team members on any given project and has to communicate with them how he imagines the artwork should look. For that, he says, he needs some help.
이제 제가 이제 큰 작업 같은 경우 혼자서 할 수 없기 때문에 다른 사람들하고 이제
When you want your team to understand your idea, you have to show them a drawing of it. But for me, that's not possible. So that's where my wife comes in. I explain to her my idea and she draws it. Then she explains what she's created and we go back and forth until we work out a final sketch together.
I turn to his wife, Yumi, who's been sitting close by during our chat.
Since you are a part of his artistic process, I'd like to get some of your thoughts too. Here, he's fine. He knows where everything is. But tell me about some of the things when you are on location that you specifically help him with.
일단 저기 그 현장 작업에 들어가기 전에요. 재료 리스트를 얘기를 해주면 제가 리스트를 작성을 합니다. 그래서 리스트를 작성을 해낸 상태.
So the first work she does for him is making the list of the materials. When the workspace is bright, he can distinguish the color of the balloons somehow, but when it's dark, he needs her help. When he wants to check the overall shape and the overall process of it, she explains to him, and then checking with the overall execution and check and correcting together.
But that partnership almost didn't happen, as Hong Sok explains.
결혼 단계에서는 많이 반대를 하셨거든요. 그게 이제 제가 장애가 장애를 갖고 있다는 부분이었는데.
When I wanted to marry Yumi, her parents were very against the marriage. I understand where they were coming from. Maybe if I were a parent, I would feel the same way. They didn't want me to burden her for the rest of her life. I think people generally feel sympathy for people with disabilities, but when the disability directly affects them, then they have a hard time accepting the situation.
How did you guys end up convincing your parents-in-laws to let the marriage go ahead?
설득은 어렵다고 생각해서 밀어붙였고요. 그다음에 살아가는 과정에 대해서
We thought it would be difficult to convince them, so we just eloped. We figured that after they get to know me, they'd accept it.
과정 안에서
Hong-seok says now he and his in-laws get along just fine. And like how he exceeded their expectations, he also exceeded mine. Here's the thing. I'm also legally blind, though Hong-seok and I have different conditions. I've never had much interest in art. I've always felt that it's inaccessible to people like me. But Hong-seok challenged this notion.
As someone who is also legally blind, I've always felt that art is something that can only be appreciated by people who have normal vision. Do you think I've been mistaken my whole life?
아까 말한 대로 이제 제이슨이 생각한 것처럼 눈이 안 보이는데 이게
Without balloons, I would have thought the same way as you, Jason. Visual art is for visual people. But through balloons, it's not about what you can see. It's more about just seeing images. For me, this was a way to overcome my limitations. I know people think that it's impossible for a non-visual person to appreciate visual art, but I found a way to do it with balloons. Seeing is not the only way to appreciate art.
That's great, man. I'm being sincere when I say that you have opened up my mind to something that I had never considered before.
I'm glad.
For the world, Jason Strother, Songnam, South Korea.
Those balloon sculptures really are astonishing. We have photos over at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills. Ecuador was about to introduce a resolution at the World Health Assembly to encourage breastfeeding over baby formula. Then the U.S. shot it down.
The Trump administration has made it so clear that they will support the private sector over health benefits of thousands and millions of babies.
That story coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. This spring, delegates from around the globe gathered for the World Health Assembly in Geneva. It's an annual gathering that sets the agenda for the UN's World Health Organization. This year, Ecuador planned to introduce a resolution to encourage breastfeeding. It was expected to pass relatively quickly and easily, until the Trump administration got involved. U.S. delegates reportedly told their counterparts from Ecuador that unless they dropped the resolution, their country would be hit with punitive trade measures and the withdrawal of U.S. military aid. In the end, a watered-down version of the resolution was passed. Amruta Byatnal is a journalist at Malnutrition Deeply, one of News Deeply's single-topic news platforms. Amruta, what was in the resolution that made the U.S. so upset?
Right, Carol. So the resolution had been in the process of sort of being worked upon for the last couple of months. And what activists and member states from a lot of different countries wanted in the resolution was really sort of stricter guidelines for governments to, you know, establish the control over the sale and the marketing of breast milk substitutes, which is like formula food, you know, food that is given to babies, and encourage breastfeeding instead. The fact that the U.S. opposed it, this gives teeth to the formula companies. The formula, baby formula industry is huge, as you know, and that's why this is so important.
Because all sorts of medical research and scientific research has shown that breastfeeding is much better for an infant than baby formula. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And especially in the first 1,000 days, breastfeeding is the best that the baby can get.
Give us an example of aggressive marketing that in the past has occurred by infant formula companies that this resolution is trying to stop.
There are a couple examples. Aggressive marketing could mean that grocery stores where mothers go to buy these products are full of infant formula and they don't really say what is good for the baby and what's not good for the baby. Another practice that has been exposed in the media is that doctors themselves encourage mothers to feed their babies with infant formula instead of breastfeeding. So that's a sort of direct conflict of interest. It's also very directly a result of how much of a control that the formula industry has on the health, on the global health sector itself.
What do you think about the statement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that said they just wanted to make sure that women who are unable to breastfeed have access to other ways to feed their children without being stigmatized?
Well, I think that's an interesting way of saying that they are going to, you know, encourage the private sector, and because there are other ways to encourage women to sort of make sure that they are in the right condition, that, you know, they can breastfeed as long as they can, but also encouraging them to know what their options are. But the way that the resolution was passed and the way that the negotiations have been, even in the past, even before this World Health Assembly, is that the agenda seems to be that the private sector is more important.
How does the resolution that was finally agreed upon, how does the language in it differ from the original one that was proposed?
The main thing is that advocates want every country to adhere to this code, which is the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, which has been supported by the World Health Organization. The idea of the resolution was to strengthen this code and to strengthen sort of implementation around this code, which didn't happen eventually in the final version. So the original proposed action on private sector interference, it also called for, you know, the fact that countries could ask for help from the World Health Organization if they wanted support. But the final resolution doesn't include that. It highlights the importance of breastfeeding, but then it doesn't really say anything about aggressive marketing and what countries can do to stop aggressive marketing.
What does it mean to health advocates that the Trump administration has sided with the private sector in this case?
Right. So in this specific case, the fact that the Trump administration has made it so clear that they will support the private sector over health benefits of thousands and millions of babies is that this will sort of be encouraged at all levels, and that the U.S.'s role will spread way beyond the United States itself. The U.S. is going to have a role in how babies are fed and the nutrition of babies in different countries, and especially in poor and developing countries.
Amruta Bjatnal is a journalist at Malnutrition Deeply, a single-topic news platform. Thank you, Amruta.
Thank you so much.
Along with breastfeeding, doctors around the globe recommend that new parents vaccinate their infants. And as kids grow, many schools demand proof of vaccination before a child can be enrolled. But that's about to change in Italy. Last week, the government there announced a change in policy. Parents who want to enroll their children in public schools will no longer need to show proof that the kids' shots are up to date. Officials said the goal was to simplify enrollment and encourage participation. Critics say the move could hurt the public's trust in science and modern medicine. Roberto Burioni is following this debate closely. He's a virologist at San Raffaele University in Milan. Dr. Burioni, what is this all about?
Actually, it's been presented like a bureaucratic issue, relieving from red tape families. But what's really surprising is that here in Italy, for participating, say, swimming class, you need a certificate from the doctor. For attending a school where you can infect other kids, you just can write off that your son is vaccinated, and that's it. This is a little bit, you know, surprising, because vaccination is a public health issue of major importance.
So you're saying there's more regulation and red tape around a child taking a swimming lesson than there is for a child entering a public school, where if they haven't been vaccinated, they could affect the other students?
Sure. I had to present a certificate for my daughter, 7-year daughter, for having her participating to a basketball class. But I now don't need anymore to present a certificate issued by a doctor for having her attend to second grade school.
Dr. Burioni, give us a sense of the recent history about vaccinations, and particularly this measles outbreak that occurred.
Unfortunately, in 2015, after a continuous decrease of vaccination coverage on measles, We experienced huge epidemics with almost 7,000 cases and several deaths. This is due to the low coverage, because our coverage in 2015 was around 85-86%. This is at the same level of Namibia, and it's lower than it is in Ghana. This is a sort of expected event, because with such a low coverage, you can have epidemics. And we must work for not having this again. And we have to vaccinate children, but we have also to catch up adults, because many children that have not been vaccinated in the last years are now they are grown up, and we have to vaccinate them as well.
So there are 10 required vaccinations in Italy, and that's gone up in recent years?
Yeah, we used to have only 4 vaccinations required, but there was no fine. Nothing happened if you didn't vaccinate your son. So basically, it was only a hypothetical law, because there was no way of enforcing it. Now, since last summer, 10 vaccinations are required for attending a preschool. This year, there's been a huge increase of coverage, and now they want to modify the law. What's a little bit more worrying is that the Minister of the Interior Affairs said a few weeks ago that 10 vaccines are too many. And this is a little bit surprising, because from the scientific point of view, there is no basis.
Now, the 2017 law that you mentioned that now requires 10 vaccines, that was in part a response to that measles outbreak?
Yes, that was a response, because a measles vaccine was one of the vaccines that were not compulsory in the previous regime.
In the U.S., there has been controversy and concern about vaccinations, and yet scientific studies that are made rule them all safe. Is there that kind of concern in Italy around certain vaccinations?
Yeah, there is the usual, you know, concern about vaccination and autism that has been reinforced, because some sentences from courts established a link between vaccination and autism, and this generated a lot of confusion in the parents. We try to do our best for convincing people that these are only superstitions. They have no reason to worry about this.
As a doctor yourself, how do you react to the idea that the government seems to be casting doubt on the effectiveness of vaccinations?
Should this be the case, it would be very, very bad, because the government should be on the side of the doctors. The government should be on the side of the health, and the government should not cast doubts on medical practices that are safe, effective, and established in all the world.
Roberto Burioni is a virologist at San Raffaele University in Italy. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
President Trump is scheduled to begin a 4-day visit to England and Scotland on Thursday. Large anti-Trump protests are expected in London on Friday. And floating above some of those protesters, look for a 20-foot-tall inflatable version of the president as a baby. Max Wakefield is one of the parents of the crowdsourced Trump baby balloon. He says they've got nearly all the permits they need to fly the balloon on Friday.
It's very large. It is bright orange, with the exception of the lower third, which is white because he's wearing a large diaper. He's got some very small orange hands, and in one of the hands, he's holding a phone logged into Twitter, so he could tweet at all times. Moving a little bit further up him, he's wearing a very malevolent, kind of constipated expression. And on top of that, there's a huge yellow quiff to top it all off.
So what are you trying to say with your balloon?
We are trying to say something very simple, which is that Donald Trump really is a baby. He has all the hallmarks of a really terrible infant, one that is self-obsessed, one that is incredibly impetuous and vicious. And underlying all that are the horrible trends in society that he has empowered: sexism, xenophobia, racism. And we are making a stand against that. When we started thinking about what we were going to do about this, we realized that you can't really engage in the standard tactics with Trump. I mean, he's not interested in having a conversation. He doesn't listen to criticism. He, of course, like any good bully, hates being told he's wrong. And he has no moral shame. So all the standard ways that you might try and oppose someone, they just water off a duck's back. He has a fragile ego. That's the key thing here. And so we've set out to ridicule and humiliate him as our key tactic, and it seems to be working.
So, of course, all those adjectives you used about Donald Trump are your own opinion, and I think he would disagree with a number of them. Have you heard any reaction from the White House?
We haven't heard any reaction directly from the White House. We know that Donald Trump is aware of the baby Trump balloon, confirmed that the other day when he was asked by a journalist. We've also seen sources in the White House saying that officials looking after Trump's visit are very keen to keep him away from Trump baby in case he starts lashing out. I think that was the phrase. So we're pretty confident that we have reached him with it, and it seems to be having the desired effect.
Where will the Trump balloon be seen during President Trump's visit to Britain?
It will be flying in the sky above Parliament Square. So Trump baby is going to be juxtaposed against this icon of the British political establishment. And, you know, that's important because it's our way of saying that he should never have been invited by our politicians in the first place. But we've also got to remember that it's not just Trump, the person, that we're protesting here. It's the politics that he represents. And actually, our government in the UK has policies that Trump would probably be quite proud of. I mean, we have one of the most brutal immigration systems in Europe. We lock people up indefinitely just for being foreign, even people who are victims of torture. And, you know, we're expanding airports at the same time as pretending to care about climate change.
So how come you don't have a giant Theresa May balloon?
I mean, it's something that we, you know, maybe we should consider after the success of this one. I think what has really got people is just how well we've captured the essence of what lies at the root of Donald Trump. The internal world of Donald Trump is utterly self-obsessed and fragile. And I don't know if that's the same with Theresa May. So I don't know if a balloon ridiculing Theresa May is actually the best way to protest her, even if many of her policies are ones that we would disagree with.
Former Brexit campaigner Nigel Farage has said the Trump baby balloon is the biggest insult ever to a sitting US president. How do you respond to that?
Oh, look, I mean, I couldn't be more pleased that Nigel Farage has said that. You know, we knew that we were onto something once we started firing up people like Nigel Farage. And, you know, if he thinks this is the greatest insult to a sitting US president, well, we're happy with that because we think Donald Trump is the greatest insult to the US presidency. We're now very much in the firing line for people who might not have heard about us otherwise. And we've received some unpleasant emails and some unpleasant phone calls. But again, you kind of know you're doing something right when you're getting this much attention and you're, you know, actually getting as much support as we are. We're having donations to the crowdfunder, signatures on the petition pouring in. We're taking the necessary precautions, but we also believe that really the risk is quite low.
In some ways, this sounds like kind of just a sort of teenage stunt. What's the point after all is said and done?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's been said, and it's a question that often gets put to us. I mean, I guess I would say this is not the first time people have lampooned political leaders, right? What we're doing is in a long tradition of political satire. It's really no different to newspapers running cartoons, which they do every day. I mean, this is basically just a 3D cartoon. And why does political satire exist? Well, it exists because when people are more powerful than you, you want to try and hold them to account. You have to use the tools you have available to you. And actually, mocking and ridiculing leaders is one way of undermining their power and reminding them that they can't just do what they want. So it's not a mistake that we've ended up choosing this particular tactic, depicting him as a baby. There's a serious point there. He governs like a child, and that is dangerous for everyone.
And of course, those are all your opinions. Max Wakefield is one of the parents of the Trump baby balloon intended to protest Donald Trump's visit to London later this week. Thanks, Max.
That was a pleasure.
Tonight, President Trump makes it official. He's expected to formally announce his pick for a new Supreme Court justice to replace Anthony Kennedy, who's retiring. Trump's choice could shape the court for years to come, and we'll be hearing a lot about that in the days ahead. Meanwhile, here's a reminder of how consequential Supreme Court decisions can be. 2 weeks ago, the court upheld President Trump's latest travel ban. That in itself was big, but in his majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts went out of his way to overturn a previous ruling by the court. That was the 1944 Korematsu decision, which allowed the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Roberts wrote that Korematsu was gravely wrong the day it was decided and has no place in law under the Constitution. There are some who want the court to overturn another ruling dating back to World War II. Eric Muller is a law professor at the University of North Carolina. He thinks the court should revisit the case of Gordon Hirabayashi.
Gordon Hirabayashi was a young man, a student at the University of Washington in Seattle in 1942 when the government imposed the restrictions pursuant to the president's executive order on Japanese Americans. The restrictions that he fought were actually not removal from the coast, which was what the Korematsu decision was about. He fought the curfew that had been imposed on American citizens of Japanese ancestry in March of 1942. He refused to stay at home at night and ended up getting arrested and took his challenge to the lawfulness of that curfew all the way to the Supreme Court. And in the Hirabayashi decision, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of this curfew that was imposed just on American citizens of Japanese ancestry and not on American citizens of German or Italian ancestry, even though we were at war with those two countries as well.
So on paper, that still stands as constitutional.
It does. In fact, it, not only does it still stand as constitutional, but somewhat concerningly, unlike the Korematsu decision, the one that the court overturned 2 weeks ago, which for decades had fallen into disrepute, the Hirabayashi decision has kind of flown off the radar screen. It was never as well known as the Korematsu case that came later, but it really established pretty much the same legal principle and is therefore just as dangerous as the Korematsu decision was, and you might even argue more dangerous because lawyers and judges actually have cited the Hirabayashi decision favorably in opinions and briefs over the years, including very recently. Just a few months ago, lawyers for the Department of Defense in a case pending in the Guantanamo Tribunal cited and relied upon language from the Hirabayashi decision in a brief. And so unlike Korematsu, which was pretty much, you know, dead as a doornail in terms of precedent for quite some time now, the Hirabayashi case is still somewhat alive and kicking, and therefore much more worrisome because it could more easily be used in a future case to support action taken against people on the basis of their ancestry or their national origin or their religion.
So technically right now, the executive could curtail the liberties of a particular ethnic or religious group, citing Hirabayashi. Would that only be in a time of war or any time?
Well, the Hirabayashi decision itself was a proposition about deference to the executive during wartime. They were fairly clear in the Hirabayashi decision that they were articulating rules about what the president could and couldn't do in time of war. So if the government were to invoke or to try to use the Hirabayashi decision most directly, they would want to use it in a context of a declared war. We don't have very many of those anymore, though. So certainly it would be available for restrictions that might be imposed in the context of, you know, non-state terrorism, the kind of stuff that we saw on 9/11 and the kinds of concerns that we continue to have, you know, in the context of our current refugee and immigration discussions.
You want this ruling overturned, but how can the Supreme Court rule on the case without a new case being filed? I mean, there's nothing pending at the moment, is there?
That's correct. There is nothing pending at the moment. But if the court wanted to do it, it would do it probably in the same way as it did in the Korematsu, or I'm sorry, in the travel ban case 2 weeks ago. The travel ban case did not directly present the identical factual situation as Korematsu. Korematsu was about the mass removal of American citizens from the West Coast on the basis of their race. The travel ban case was not about that. It was about non-citizens and their rights at the border as they tried to travel into the United States. Nonetheless, the court took the opportunity for, you know, sort of from the rough similarity of some of the legal issues to go out of its way to say, look, this decision from 75 years ago has been overruled in the court of history and it was wrong when it was decided. I would imagine that a similar case within the next few years, given the world that we're living in and the concerns about terrorism and about favoring or disfavoring certain people for immigration into the United States on the basis of things like national origin and ancestry and religion, surely some sort of case will present itself with at least sufficient similarities to the issues in Hirabayashi that the court could take the opportunity to just go ahead and do for Hirabayashi what it did 2 weeks ago for Korematsu.
Whatever happened to the man at the center of this case, Gordon Hirabayashi?
A fascinating story. Gordon Hirabayashi served time in a prison camp in Arizona as a result of this conviction. And then when he was released, he then took the opportunity to make another act of resistance, which was to resist the military draft. In 1944, the government began drafting Japanese Americans out of the camps into the U.S. Army. And he was then prosecuted and convicted a second time for draft evasion, along with several hundred other Japanese American men in 1944. After the war, he went on and became a very successful academic and had a very distinguished career in academia.
And is he still alive?
No, he passed away a number of years ago. His children have remained very active. Jay Hirabayashi, for example, has remained very active in these kinds of civil rights causes. And in fact, he and the children of a couple of the other Supreme Court litigants from those Japanese-American cases in World War II have kind of banded together as a second-generation litigating force, and they have continued to file together briefs and pleadings in cases in which they are feel that they're able to speak with some authority about the civil rights deprivations that their fathers endured during World War II.
Eric Muller is a law professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you very much.
Whichever cases the Supreme Court takes up next session, the outcome could well depend on the nominee that President Trump is set to announce tonight. That and the fate of other Supreme Court precedents, of course, including Roe v. Wade. Like I said earlier, we'll be hearing a lot more on that in the days ahead. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.